time to podcast.
Welcome, everyone, into the Hyper Time. The Hyper Time to podcast. I am your host, Josh Miller, bringing you part two of DC, The New Frontier. And joining me to do it is the Podfather himself. And I'm going to get his name correct this time, Alan Muir. Alan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am tired. So this could be a big mess today, but we're going to push through and get it done.
All the good things I was saying about this story in the first part, Darwin stuck the landing, and as can be expected from me shilling any DC comic book I can, except ones that were written by sex offenders.
Surely there's not a lot of those in the industry.
the point you chose were like to stop reading, feel like a good part one and part two.
Yeah, I felt like that was going to be the best place. I mean, like I told you, I read the two volume, and that's where the first one ends. But I know you ended up picking up the deluxe version.
No, actually, I'd owned the deluxe edition for quite a while.
Oh, okay.
I have so many comic books in my room, on my iPad, on my phone. It feels like they're slowly making an attempt on my life.
Yeah, I think at one point I might take pictures of the books I own and start putting them up on Twitter just to give people an idea of what I am trying to work with here.
Yeah, there's a certain point with the John Henry stuff that I put on Instagram, on my Instagram page.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Instagram.com/comicsboy, whatever. That should be plugs, but that's my Instagram account is solely for comics. So it's a good thing I'm on this podcast.
Yep. And I think I might have to start doing more stuff like that on the Twitter, too, instead of just mainly focusing on the episodes we're doing. I might try and do just more random panels and stuff that I like, or whatever is topical at the time.
If I remember correctly, the comic book panels out of context, that guy was a gatekeeper, so anything's possible.
It's possible. So yeah, for today, for this part two of New Frontier, we've kind of already went over how everything began, so we won't have the beginning facts that we normally do. Instead, we'll kind of jump right into the story part of it, and then we'll have more kind of bonus stuff at the end. And there's still quite a bit of meat in this story to go through, and I think that's something that Darwin did pretty well. You know, if you're new to the story, I feel like maybe it is not quite as fast-paced as you might expect it to be. But in the second part, it ramps up quite a bit. And I think it's kind of more what people were hoping for.
There was a character who appears at the end who I didn't expect to appear.
Yeah, he just kind of comes out of nowhere.
He just comes out of the ocean with Superman saying, "Yeah, I am so-and-so." And yeah, I was like, okay. You had this good faith for me from effectively writing some really good stories. So
yeah, if I remember right, same that character kind of he does show up for maybe a page or two really quick, like he's preparing to go to war, but then he never actually shows up for the war.
Yeah,
I'm like, where'd you go? They could have used your help. Where'd you go?
And I want to say that, or I'll wait till we get to the end, because I have a theory about and like an homage done with that. In New 52 Justice League.
Okay. I think I have an idea what you're thinking of, but we'll see when we get there. So let's get into the story.
Where do we last leave off?
There was the threat of the center that Martian Manhunter had gleaned from checking out a book that Batman had given him the ability to finally unlock after their encounter at the church. And he realized that this big threat from, at least from the Viking days, since the book was a story from a Viking telling him of this dinosaur island that was more of a threat than I think anyone expected. And it's basically on its way, or technically already here. And so part two is basically going to be more of that, more of the center kind of finding its way into people's minds, driving people a little bit crazy, and then the ultimate assault on all the superheroes. And yeah, it gets pretty action-packed.
And we also get more of the government than we did in the beginning of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we open up this part of the story is exactly how I exactly like if they did this character in real life, like the story's set in the 50s, I would not be surprised at all if they did the same thing now.
Where we left off, Gorilla Grodd in Central City, and the Flash tries to intercept Gorilla Grodd and stop him, but is attacked by Faraday and the government. And it seems that Faraday has some plans for the Flash, and he's going to try and make him government property.
And who does he tell him that he's going to be joining?
He is planning on joining Rex Tyler, someone who makes a very brief appearance at the beginning of New Frontier during some rooftop escapades that leads to his death. And so Faraday tells Flash he's going to become government property and decides to try and trank him, but Flash is able to vibrate away and escape, which we will see him again a little bit later.
Yeah, I don't get why you certain other characters you can do this with, but it's the Flash. He's literally the fastest man alive. If he wanted to, he could have just, instead of running away, he could have just pulled the Neobard and just done a fist through the heart.
Yeah, the Flash is always one of those characters. It's kind of fun to see how writers take him on because there's kind of no reason he can't solve everything in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, Dwayne McDuffie would always he would always say that like the hardest character to write for was like when they were doing just the Justice League cartoon was Flash, because there's no reason why he can't with his power set. Why he can't just be the Flash that we see in Kingdom Come.
Yep.
Where he's literally everywhere at once.
He is just like the living embodiment of the Speed Force.
Yeah, I mean, when we eventually get to Kingdom Come, I'll have more to say.
And so from there, to go to another Silver Age hero, we see Hal and Carol meet up with Ace at a car show, and Ace introduces them to the newest challenger of the unknown in June Robbins. And then it changes scenes again. Because that's what a lot of New Frontier is just kind of jumping between everything. We see John Jones as he inter-monologues about the John Henry character and how he is a true American hero fighting for the oppressed, but is sad that it isn't covered as widely as it should be. He's then called into an interrogation room where a former engineer at Ferris Aircraft has mentally lost it, so it would seem. He rambles on about how he saw a folder mentioning Martians are on Earth and how the U.S. is going to go to Mars. And as John is in there interrogating him, Faraday interrupts and takes the man away in fear of him spreading confidential information. John says goodbye to Faraday, but because of his mind reading, learns that everything the engineer said is true.
The guy who's lost his marbles sort of sets everything in motion. Think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the one who finally tips off to John that, well, Martian Manhunter, I guess, that the government is more aware of him being there than he thought they were. And so he's going to try to, use that to his advantage later on in the book. So from there, we see Hal Jordan, Rick Flagg, and the rest of the crew. They're testing their shuttle before they go into space. And Hal is being Hal and showboating too much, which angers Flagg, which kicks him off the team and puts him in the doghouse with Carol after Flagg kind of goes full ham on her.
And then we get to the part that just made me die.
Yeah, this one was rough. So back in Tennessee, we see that the John Henry character is worse for wear. The KKK are hunting him down and he's hurt. He stumbles across a little white girl who he begs for help, pulling his mask up so she can look him in the eyes. Unfortunately for him, the racist goes deep and she rats him out.
Yeah, she literally says the N-word is here.
Yep.
Come get him. And I just, oh man.
It was, whew. So then, yeah, we see a news report is shown detailing that the man was actually named John Wilson. He was a man whom he and his family had been dragged out of their home by domestic terrorists who fought against the terrorism and became a symbol of hope. It all ended for him when he was beaten, hung, and burned alive. He was a veteran of the Korean War. Then they show a picture of him and his wife and his newborn in a much happier time after he came home. And then they show the picture of whom he became, this black hooded figure with a noose hanging around his neck, hunting down the Ku Klux Klan. And we see other people around the U.S. watching this news report, such as Clark Kent, Lois Lane, and John Jones. John becomes worried that something similar will happen if someone were to find a Martian on Earth. And so the reader then takes a trip to Paradise Island, where Wonder Woman is lounging before she catches Superman in the sky, which, as anyone who is aware of Paradise Island, no men are supposed to be allowed there. And so she greets him up in the sky, and they decide to fly around. He wonders why she has disappeared, and she tells him what happened the day she received the medal. She tells Superman the world doesn't need another administration. They need a leader, one with ideals and values and not an agenda. Basically, putting it on...
Putting everything on Superman.
Mm-hmm.
Because they mention her retirement, which is sort of what happened with Wonder Woman back in... Not in the comics, but between the Golden Age and Silver Age.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the few characters that technically survived. Like, at a certain point, the JSA went away. At a certain point, everything got... Or as I mentioned in a different episode, All-Star Comics eventually became All-Star Western. And everyone started getting fixated on Westerns. And there's a little Easter egg near the end that I'll get to. So
from there, we go to Gotham again, where we see John Jones in his Martian form watching another broadcast. This time it's one that the Flash interrupts. He tells the world that the government tried to capture him when all he's ever done is try to help other people. With the government hunting him down instead of the over 4,000 unsolved cases, he doesn't want to put his loved ones in danger and that he's retiring. So John kind of comes to the conclusion that between how the Flash is treated and how John Wilson was treated, he decides he's going to go back to Mars. So he meets Batman at the Bat Signal and then tells him all the details he learned since their last meeting and that they can all be found in the apartment before he splits. Yep,
it's Batman 101. He turns to say something to him, he's gone.
Yep.
And I think, doesn't Gordon comment on that?
I believe he does.
And he then asks John if he wants to go get a drink.
Yeah, so John turns around and, you know, tells him that he'll find hundreds of case files and related stories at his apartment. And as he's turning around, he says, they're all yo, and then realizes Batman's gone. And Jim's like, he's like that. It can be maddening. Jim's like, it's been a real pleasure serving with you, John. How about we go meet Slam for one last round at Jimmy's? He's like, that'd be tops, Jim. That would be tops. And then we see Batman on a splash page checking all these notes that John had left him. A few of the notes detail the concern of the center that he kept coming across. Clippings of Dinosaur Island and a man in Arkham by the name of Adam Strange and other details. So Flag and the crew are aboard the ship to head to Mars in the next scene. However, as they get ready for takeoff, Faraday notices an odd figure in the smoke surrounding the ship. He confronts it and knows it's a Martian, John Jones. John quickly disarms Faraday and realizes that the ship is about to take off, which would kill Faraday from the rocket flames. So he saves Faraday, but because Martians have a thing with fire, basically goes unconscious because of it. And when he finally comes to, he wakes up in a containment cell with Faraday looking on, and John explains to Faraday why he didn't let him die, and that he's seen inside his mind, and he's trying to fight the good fight. And seeing all of that, John has been filled with hope.
And it's where we see our potential antagonist character take an unseen left turn.
Yeah, that was kind of the point in which Faraday turns, kind of, I guess, to the good side, in a way. It kind of felt like he was being put into the position of the, you know, as you mentioned, the antagonist, at least a secondary antagonist.
Yeah, like a secondary antagonist, basically a nameless government hound dog.
Mm-hmm. But John kind of gets through to him. As Faraday and John are talking, Faraday receives news that the shuttle is in trouble with the loss of power. Flag gets on the line with Jordan. He explains that during the last big war, he became close friends with three other people. King Faraday, which I think this is the first time Faraday is given a first name, which is a great first name, by the way, King Faraday.
Yeah, and John Jones's fascination with that was really well explained.
So yeah, King Faraday was one friend, Ace Morgan was the other, and then Hal's dad, Martin Jordan. Those four kept close eyes on Hal after Martin died, knowing how much he loved his family. Ace watched him over Korea. Flag figured it was his turn when Hal got to Ferris Aircraft. He didn't let Hal on the craft because he knew the rate of survival was low. And because of his friendship with Martin, he couldn't let Hal die up there too. But at the same time, we see the Challengers of the Unknown rocket towards space in an attempt to save Flag and his crew. However, Faraday informs them to abort, but Ace drowns him out as a refusal to listen. He tries to call in Superman, who's in a battle with a giant robot in Tokyo.
Oh man, that was out of context. Looking at it, you're like, what is this?
Yep.
And then you just, oh, okay.
Oh yeah, Superman does other things too.
It reminded me of the Fleischer cartoons.
A little bit, yeah. I need to go back and watch those. It's been a long time.
Yeah, like, I mean, there is a specific Fleischer cartoon where he's fighting very of-the-era robots. giant robots. But this is an Eastern take on said robots.
Yep. So when calling in Superman fails, Faraday informs the people around him that the ship had 3 warheads in case the Martians were found to be a threat. There is a viral warhead, a nerve agent, and a hydrogen bomb. And if it were to come back to Earth, they'll detonate there, and Nose Flag has to detonate it before it reaches the atmosphere. The Challengers don't know this, though, and so they're in the process of saving the rocket when Superman finally arrives on time. And it's in those final moments before Flag pulls the trigger that we see his dreams of the life that could have been, the life with the love of his life, and fellow crewmate Karen. As the rocket explodes, Superman is able to save the 2 Challengers who are attached to the rocket and would have died either from the explosion or re-entering the atmosphere. And soon after, we see the funeral of Karen and Flag, and Faraday is seen grieving one of his few friends. There's a lot of humanizing with Faraday in just that short amount of time between talking with John and the funeral of his friend. Didn't have to be dragged out. It was just very well done and got the point across pretty easily.
Yeah, I mean, it's very ironic thinking about the animated movie.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Like, it's Phil Morris who voices King Faraday, and I'm pretty sure you know who he is well known as. Martian Manhunter in Smallville.
That's right, yeah, he was.
So it's once I remembered that, I just couldn't stop laughing.
I'm trying to think, was the animated movie before he started Smallville? It's what, like 2000?
It was 2008.
2008, that's right.
So it was sort of like around season 6.
So it was roughly around the same time.
Yeah.
So from there, we see Hal finally become the hero he was destined to be. There's a flash of green. Hal disappears and leaves a destroyed simulation room that Carol walks in on. Ace Morgan is on the phone with Hal and unable to tell Ace what happened. Hal hangs up. He's holding his ring and heads back down to the spaceship and alien that crashed. We then see Abin Sur being hit with a bright beam of yellow energy that almost kills him. Fearing the end of his life, he sought out a human worthy enough to wear the ring, which is Hal.
So what I did when this part happened in the book, I immediately put on the Green Lantern trailer from like 9 years ago. Man, I just need to... We don't have a Green Lantern show. We don't have a good Green Lantern movie.
I need to go back and rewatch the animated Green Lantern series.
Yeah. Have you seen, not First Flight, the other one, the anthology one?
Yeah. It's been a while, but yeah, I've seen them.
That's so good.
So as Hal gets the ring, he becomes, obviously, the Green Lantern. And his first act is to fly like he's never flown before. But as he heads into space, he sees a vision of the Guardians and realizes that he can't do that yet. So he heads back down and buries Abin Sur very sloppily under a giant mountain after being spooked by a snake.
Well, initially he buries him the way Kirk is buried in Star Trek Generations, just under a pile of rocks.
Yeah, it's funny. He's like, I'm going to put this mountain basically on top of you. And then,
yeah, just in case someone does find you,
mm-hmm.
There'll just be nothing left.
From there, we see Lois and Jimmy interviewing and photographing the Challengers of the Unknown. But then an alarm goes off, and as the professor and June run off, they allow Jimmy and Lois to follow and see how they deal with things. From there, we see Clark looking over some information provided by Bruce, and it's the story of the King of Monster Island, created by a children's book writer who killed himself upon completing the story. And it's the story of the Center, a being born on Earth a millennia ago, who saved dinosaurs upon the impact of the asteroid that caused the Ice Age. Its body became an island that the dinosaurs could live on, and as time passed and humans evolved, becoming more and more violent, culminating in the hydrogen bomb, the center decided it had to take action. It was going to rid the planet of humans and then leave Earth to explore the galaxy.
Yeah, they could have just taken up all the nuclear energy and just left. Like Sergei Lannis, the pilot, just going off into the universe.
I mean, at least the center has the courtesy of wiping out all of humanity. Like, I'm going to do the Earth a favor and just wipe out you creatures because you're just destroying everything. And so with all this knowledge, Superman travels to Gotham and meets up with a newly designed Batman, along with his new and very excited sidekick, Robin.
Who's just doing, like, handstands and somersaults
yeah.
the entire time, like, that him and that Bruce and Clark are talking.
Yeah, usually, like, if you see a Batman flashback to Robin, it's typically, like, this happy-go-lucky kid who's just bouncing off the walls and everything. Especially anytime it shows him meeting Superman for the first time. And that's basically what we see here is just, as you mentioned, just like a somersaulting Robin just all over the place.
It's just a ball of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is kind of harkening back to that scene in the church where he goes to save the kid. And the kid, like,
just screams in terror.
Yeah. So this is Batman trying to get a less frightening approach to how he fights crime and, you know, potentially saves children. So Batman tells Superman that something must have been speaking through the author, as it reads like nothing else he previously wrote. And Batman is fearful that whatever was speaking through him will soon attack, and wanted to pass that info on to someone who actually has the power to stop it. It's also here that we learn that they staged their fight, and we'll discuss this later on. And Superman had been trying to change the government from the inside to allow people like Batman to work while he did his own thing, not caring what they decided. And so he knows it will change, but just only when they truly need them.
Okay, I just have to say something?
Sure.
If they had done this instead of Batman v Superman, like this plot, they actually get along, but they just chose to work the masses.
Yeah, funny enough, it could have worked out pretty well and probably have been better received. Especially since Wonder Woman is also a part of this fight, in a way. So, it still would have worked out in that movie.
But then we got Justice League.
Then we got Justice League. Which, I'm going to be honest, I actually like Justice League. But I know I'm in the minority.
I mean, one of the writers, or the writer, just broke Star Wars forever. I will never forgive Chris Terrio.
And so we finally see at least the ominous shadow of the center as we look on at Paradise Island and it fills the sky. And I think it's here that we kind of see like Wonder Woman and some of her Amazonian friends kind of looking up, knowing that they're about to go into battle with whatever this thing is. And then we skip out to Faraday and John playing chess. John tells King he knows something is coming and thinks everyone should be prepared. Faraday knows this as well, based on reports around the country of Dread. Next scene has the Challengers with Lois and Jimmy heading towards Cape Canaveral, and they quickly learn what the trouble is. It's a giant winged creature. Thankfully, Superman is quick to arrive as well and puts the creature down pretty quickly. And then here's that scene of Aquaman preparing his army to go against the center if it's needed. And then it goes back to Superman with the others. They're told something big is headed their way. And before anything else can happen, Wonder Woman in her invisible jet crashes there. Superman pulls her out before racing her to a medic. And I don't think I've ever actually quite seen a scene with the invisible jet where it's covered with blood from the inside. So it's like the only, like you could see the outline of things because of Wonder Woman's blood.
And this is also one of the few stories I've read where they actually treat the invisible jet with respect.
Yeah.
Where they don't make it a total joke.
Can't stand when they do that. Invisible jet's pretty damn awesome. I love it. So yeah, from there we see the Challengers trying to locate Dinosaur Island to no avail. It seems to be completely missing, but then catches a news report by Lois Lane who convinced someone to pilot a helicopter out to recon what was headed towards Cape Canaveral. And it is indeed something big. They gauge it at probably 25 miles across. And it's a floating island with different flying creatures surrounding it, attacking jets that are surrounding it. It's able to transmit a buzz in the minds of anyone around, and the entire body is covered with smaller creatures. And there are large ports on the side that emit energy or pull things into it. And there's also one underneath that, I can't remember if it's energy or if it's that basically keeps it afloat in the sky. It's our first like real view of what the center actually is. And Lois is being shown everywhere. And so we see Barry Allen watching at home and decides it's time to become the Flash again. And Iris is ahead of him, telling him how she always knew a secret and reassures him.
She goes like that she's a reporter. She already knew this and he wanted to help. He became the Flash to help people. And basically, yeah, just go out there and show everyone who the Flash really is.
Yep. It's nice when writers allow other characters to not be completely stupid in the lives of the heroes.
Iris sort of had troubled history, but in this, they just nail it.
Yep. Like in this, I feel like Iris and Lois are very similar in how Darwin approached them both. And I think it's how both characters basically should be written. There are investigative reporters. They're incredibly smart. They know how to come to conclusions. And there's really no reason that either of these superhero, you know, boyfriends or whatever should have that mystery be a mystery, especially when they're as close as Barry and Iris are. I know Lois and Superman aren't quite there yet in this story, but that was always one of the things that bothered me with their relationship, is how Lois never quite put the pieces together.
I remember watching the Flash and Arrow crossover, where, like, during season one of the Flash, Barry was sort of playing homewrecker to Iris and Eddie Thawne's relationship. They were basically just doing the Superman Lois thing, and Iris goes, "Do you have a name?" And Flash goes, "You mean like Ralph?" And I'm like, and at first I didn't get it. Then I just, and then I, a few minutes, like a day or two later, I rewatched Superman 1. Like, oh man, this is my show.
So as Barry takes up the Flash costume again, we see Faraday letting John know that he's going to Cape Canaveral and wants to bring him along. We see Vandal Savage also locked up, claiming he has been on the island, but Faraday quickly dismisses him, which is kind of funny.
Does Faraday actually say the name Savage?
I think he says Vandal or Savage, if I remember right.
Because, like, aside from him saying Savage, I just that face, like that face is iconic.
Yeah. So Savage goes, "Faraday, don't be such a dim-witted fool. I too am receiving premonitions. I have been to this island, Faraday." And you know, it's this. It's kind of like this behind the back side view. And the character has like longer dark hair, and you can tell a beard as well. And then Faraday looks at him, points a finger, and says, "Do I look retarded to you, Savage? Shut up, or I'll have them gas you twice an hour from now on."
I mean, they could have gone the Legends route.
Yeah.
And had, like, "I taught the center how to so and so." Oh, God, I hate Vandal Savage in that show.
So, yeah, John becomes humanoid in an attempt to be less of a frightening appearance while not trying to hide that he isn't human also. So he shifts his form, and this is where we see the classic Martian Manhunter look before Faraday tells him pants are cooler. So John shifts into being a green man wearing a suit.
Yeah, basically a Martian version of Dr. Manhattan.
Basically, yeah.
Like, that's my first good way to put it. It's like he's missing the stuff, the thing on the forehead. But other than that, then these are the same characters.
Yep. And so we see other heroes are shown learning about the battle that's about to take place. We see Green Arrow and Speedy, the Sea Devils, Blackhawks, and a few more.
Oh man, I was so happy to see the Blackhawks.
I mean, there's really no reason they shouldn't be here. I'm glad the Sea Devils were in there too, because they make a good reason to show up as well.
Did you ever read the Blackhawks book from the New 52?
I think I had a few issues, but I didn't read it as long as I probably should have.
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't in the best. I think it was among the first wave of cancellations.
Was it there alongside, what was it, OMAC and...
Oh, man. Dan DiDio's Finest Hour was OMAC.
It was really good. It was really good.
Yeah, it was OMAC, Just League International. Or no, yeah, I think so.
International only lasted 12 issues, I think. Or was it 16? I can't remember.
Static.
Was Firestorm in there?
No, that lasted longer. Written by Comics Gator.
Yeah. I was kind of disappointed when Gail Simone left that book.
And, oh, because I forgot about this last week, do you mind if I just tell the JT Krull thing I found?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so I'm watching Seinfeld, like I normally do, because I'm a Long Islander. I just was watching Steinbrenner, like someone made a montage of the Steinbrenner clips, or the Steinbrenner appearances, and I see one of the like associate producer, some name which starting with J, and then I see JT Kroll. I'm like, wait, what? And I pack up a spot on and pause the video. I take a picture of it, put it in the staff chat, and tag Josh in it. And I'm just like, what, dude, what? And yeah, apparently he got a start. I mean, he got a start doing indie comics.
Yep, I had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame his Green Arrow run wasn't that good. I kind of liked his take on Captain Atom.
I'm trying to think. I think I only had the first two issues of the New 52 Atom.
Okay, so back to the story.
Okay, so one of the other people that's kind of watching everything go down is Hal, and he's Hal, so he wants to be a part of it too. He's about to take out a prototype aircraft before being stopped by Carol. He tells her he knows he's willing to kill for survival, despite people thinking he's a complete pacifist. And before he heads out, they share one last kiss in this very... It reminded me a lot of, you know, the incredibly popular picture of the like sailor or soldier coming back from war and kissing the woman on, what is it, in the middle of the street or something like that as a celebration type thing?
V-Day?
Maybe? I can't.
I know. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm terrible with history, so I can't remember the exact thing. But that's kind of what it reminded me of.
It was when Japan announced they'd be surrendering.
That sounds right.
And the scene that they show, sort of like the divergence where things go, or where things change, basically, in Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
And by Watchmen, I mean the film Watchmen by star director Zack Snyder. And I'm not saying that with any irony. He's a really good director. Watchmen is his best film.
I think, try to think of when everything started to go south for him. God, what was that? Was it Sucker Punch, maybe?
Sucker Punch was, yeah, that was, I want to say, the early 2010s.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of when people started to sour on him. Like, I feel Watchmen was pretty well received. Obviously, 300 was well received. You know, his Dawn of the Dead remake, people liked a whole lot.
I love it. You're just going, instead of like a year, like a year after, a year before, you're just going every film you're mentioning, like all before Watchmen.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Watchmen.
I mean, he is doing another original movie.
Oh, is he?
A zombie movie.
I feel like, did that one not come out yet? If it's the one I'm thinking of, I might not even be thinking of the same same director. I might be thinking of another completely different zombie movie.
The movie I was talking about is Army of the Dead.
Okay, yeah, this is something else I'm thinking of then. I don't know. I'll figure it out later. I must be thinking of something else. Anyways, back to New Frontier. So we see Wonder Woman and Superman. You know, Wonder Woman's pretty heavily injured and Superman's by her side. And Wonder Woman tells Superman of the center attacking Paradise Island. It's not so much attacking as just passing by, but the sheer number of threats it posed quickly proved impossible for the Amazonians. Wonder Woman tried to get there in time to warn them. She tells them that they have to work together and it's Superman who needs to lead them. And so Superman peeks outside to see squabbling among the troops and quickly puts a stop to it.
Well, you're forgetting that they kiss, Wonder Woman and Superman kiss.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, isn't that technically cheating?
Yeah, it's a little weird. I don't know. Yeah. I wasn't really sure how to feel about that. Like, is this more of a friendly kiss? Is this more of a...
Yeah, like the Death Star kiss?
Yeah.
But that, even that, then, that was even just creepy.
Yeah, we see Superman peeking outside to see squabbling among the troops and quickly puts a stop to it. He lays out a speech how they all need to work together to bypass any animosity with each other to help stop the force willing to wipe out everyone. And Faraday agrees and lends his support along with the U.S. government to stop the center as John continues the fight to keep the center from his mind. And so Superman decides to go out and recon the center. He's able to dispatch some of the beasts that attack him, but then the center sets out a huge blast and takes Superman out in one hit, basically causing him to crash into the ocean, which to everyone else seems like that's it. Superman's dead. Morale took a pretty hard hit with that.
At this point, we're made to think that Superman's dead, Wonder Woman's dead, because like he even says that Wonder Woman may have just given her life to warn them about Center.
Yep. Like all the big guns have just been taken out, and now you have people who all they can do is fly planes or use their bows to shoot arrows. Not quite on par with, you know, an Amazonian warrior and an alien that can shoot fire from his eyes.
Yeah, the next part, I got real happy. One of my favorite characters.
Yeah, it's kind of cool to see this scene play out, because they could have just omitted it entirely. But it's really nice to see, like, all these
older characters.
Yeah, kind of brought back. So yeah, this next scene takes place on the moon. We see the Spectre and Dr. Fate meeting up with the Phantom Stranger, Satana, and Billy Batson. And while Spectre and Dr. Fate want to intervene in the fight against, I put the Spectre, but it's supposed to be the Center.
Oh, man.
Jesus. Okay.
Hey, at least you didn't call him by a different name.
I just want everyone to know, this is like 17 pages of notes for this story, so I think I only messed up the names of like four different times. I'll tell you that.
It's a good ratio.
It's a good ratio, I like to think. So yeah, Spectre and Dr. Fate want to intervene in the fight against the Center, and the others feel it's best that they all stay out of it. They think it's the time for the heroes to prove that they are capable of doing something themselves without the help of the old generation. Kind of a nice passing of the torch challenge for them in a way. But yeah, it's kind of funny because, you know, anytime there's typically a crisis in the DC universe, oftentimes characters like the Spectre and Dr. Fate are left out entirely of it for whatever reason.
I mean, so
they're kind of OP.
Spectre was in Final Crisis.
He was in Final Crisis. He was also a big problem with Infinite Crisis as well.
Yeah, he was.
But usually they're not on the side of stopping everything.
And also, I have to say, my version of Phantom Stranger I grew up with was the New 52 version.
Oh, the
Judas.
Yep.
And man, that as soon as I saw that it was classic silver, like golden silver age Phantom Stranger, I just did that Napoleon Dynamite gif where it's just the brother just doing like the yes fist bump.
Well, unfortunately, one person isn't giving the yes fist bump because the next scene shows Lois. She's trying to do a broadcast telling everyone in the world that Superman has been defeated. But as she's doing this, she starts breaking down. Jimmy's there to try and bring her hopes up a little bit, but she's in love with Superman, and so she's kind of wrecked by having seen him go down. And then we have more people joining the fight. Bruce Wayne is in joint with LexCo to send all available aircrafts to aid in the fight. Adam Strange has been given the clearance to leave Arkham with his jetpack and gun.
And I wanted to talk about it earlier, but we're going to get to it and either way. I did like the magazine that he's reading. Are they obsessing over?
I want to go back and look at.
Let's just say that he shrinks.
Ah, gotcha. That's and, right. I remember now.
Yeah, and I see the little Easter egg. Oh yeah, I forgot that he's not that version of himself in this.
Not yet. And so we see Hal crashing in the prototype he was trying to use. But fortunately, he is able to power it up again using the ring. And then Adam Strange meets up with the person that you were hinting at, Ray Palmer. Adam thinks he knows how to defeat the Center, and it's by using a flawed invention that Ray had created.
Okay, as I've said, that this whole section of the story is like the best part of the story. Like, it's when everything's starting to all falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, there have been stories that have tried to do some stuff like this and have just failed. But just there's just something so satisfying about, like, seeing all our players take their places.
Yeah, and
just seeing what is to come.
And Darwin did a pretty good job, like, sprinkling in, like, all these little tidbits here and there throughout the story before now. And so when you're finally seeing characters like Adam Strange or Ray Palmer.
Niles Calder,
Will Magnus, you know, seeing them all start to kind of come up. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember when, you know, just that one panel back in the first, you know, the first part of the story, you know, mentioned this character. And so it's pretty nice that he was able to kind of have all of that come back around at the end and tie it up real nice. So Faraday meets up with the Flash and tries to tell Flash no hard feelings for attempting to capture him earlier.
Oh, yeah. And Flash, just Barry just punches him right in the face.
And he's one.
He punches him in the face and says, none taken. Or some one-liner.
You know, and as he's walking out, Adam Strange and Ray Palmer both walk in. And as Faraday's...
No, they ask Flash where he is.
That's right.
And he's like, you'll find him picking himself up off the floor. Like, oh, I love this.
So yeah, as they tell the plane to Faraday, as you know, Faraday's kind of gathering his bearings again. Basically, they have to relay all of it to the bigger minds at work, such as, you know, the professor from the Challengers, Will Magnus, Niles Calder. And so they kind of explain to the troops what the plan is. And so they're going to use a diversion that takes place over the entirety of the center, while another set of planes head inside to try and use some warheads to wreak havoc inside of it. However, the Flash is going to be in charge of the main goal of the attack. He will use Ray Palmer's invention to run all over the center, and Ray's invention is the shrinking ray, and they think that Flash, running as fast as he does, will cover the entire body of the center, causing it to shrink entirely. But because of the flaw in the invention, it has an inability to maintain integrity, and so this would cause the center to explode. Day be saved, hip hip hooray, war is over.
Yeah, I was about to say, this reminds me a lot of the Crisis.
Anyway, yeah. And so everyone heads out. We see a nice little, I think it was a splash page, where everyone's just kind of lined up and walking towards the camera. Kind of that, the movie that comes immediately to mind for me is Armageddon, when they're all walking towards the spacecraft.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Aerosmith playing in the background. Even though that they haven't even been, or no, I don't even know if they've been around at this point. If this was a 90s movie, Aerosmith would have been just all over the place.
Yep. So yeah, as everyone's kind of heading out, the original creature that Superman took down earlier explodes from within, and a spawn of other creatures flood the beach, and the attack on the center begins. We see planes exploding and the Sea Devils pulling people out of the water with rescue boats. Ace Morgan and Hal Jordan head inside. We see Jimmy Olsen about to be eaten as he struggles to load film just in time.
Hey, that Jimmy Olsen, he's dedicated.
He's dedicated. You don't get to where he is just by, you know, running for your life. You got to take a picture of your last moments of life.
Or just being a CIA spy, like in the head film Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice.
Jesus, God, that was so stupid. I hated it so much. So yeah, he's struggling to load film just in time to take a picture of Wonder Woman joining the fight and saving Jimmy. Faraday's trying to get John to safety, but the center finally breaks through and takes control of him. Faraday touches him, trying to force the center out of John and into himself, which succeeds, although it results in Faraday dying.
Yeah, like, how is he able to do this?
I don't know. That's kind of a... I don't know. That wasn't really explained at all. It's just kind of have to roll with it. And, yeah. It's the best I can do. Just like, okay, we're in the final act here. I guess I'll just go along with it. So, seeing Faraday die, John changes into the Martian Manhunter again, and really cuts loose, finally showing what he is capable of. And then we see Hal, Nathaniel Adams, Captain Adam to some, and Ace head into the center. Reality seems to be warping around them. It seems to be that the center is able to read their minds and shifts the landscape for each of them to reflect what it sees. Their ship starts being covered with red goop, and Hal, knowing about the weakness to yellow that the green ring has, starts seeing walls of yellow crystal form around the space he's in. As his ship explodes, he rockets out as Green Lantern. His mind is completely clear, and he sees the place around him for what it really is, the location of the brain. Nate realizes he has to press the button to release the warhead before he is overcome, and he does, explosion, and kills himself.
Do you notice what happens as he dies?
What was that?
They basically just allude to being his origin for becoming Captain Atom.
Oh, okay.
The way that, like, the bomb goes off and there's, like, an outline of his body where...
Oh, yeah, I see what you're talking about. Yeah, like, the whole panel is, like, a big yellow explosion, but his body is completely outlined and the body itself is nothing, but it almost looks like energy in a way.
Yeah.
But as the explosion goes off, Hal is able to save Ace, and they start heading out of the center. And so now it's the Flash's turn. He speeds over the water and leaps off a wave, sending him on top of the center. As Hal and Ace watch on, Flash weaves and dodges the creatures as Ray's machine starts covering the surface. As Flash starts to doubt his capability of success, he sees Wonder Woman and the Martian Manhunter fighting above, trying to aid him, giving him inspiration. He thinks back on Iris and not wanting to let her down. And after succeeding to cover the entire center with Ray's machine, he leaps off and is saved by Wonder Woman. Before the center can explode, Hal creates a bubble around it to contain the blast. And with approval from the Guardians, he's able to travel into space and throws it far into the distance where it can detonate without destroying anything. And he uses his victory lap to fly around space, the one place he's always wanted to visit. From there, we see night falling, and the heroes are gathered around the beach. Suddenly, something comes up out of the water. Everyone's kind of worried. It's another, it's another attack from one of the center's creatures. But as it opens up, we see Superman being carried by Aquaman. Aquaman mentions that Superman hasn't shut up about a woman named Lois, who quickly runs into his arms as Jimmy takes one last photo to commemorate the victory, showcasing all of the heroes. And so we see the epilogue here, showing flashes of everything with the backdrop of a JFK speech. Some things we see, Aquaman reveals himself to the world, John Wilson's gravestone and a black child written comic with the name Irons on his back sitting next to it, which was a nice little touch for Steel. Ray learning to perfect his invention and shrinking himself. We see Rick Flagg's son reading a report about his dad to his class. New teams of heroes such as the Doom Patrol and the Metal Men, formation of the Justice League of America, and more.
Oh, man. Yeah, and just the next part.
Yeah, so the last scene, we see a creature that had come from the center, a giant starfish that comes out of the water, which is a nod to the famous cover of Brave and the Bold, issue 28, back in 1960, where the Justice League fights Starro.
This has nothing to do with New Frontier. Have you heard of Jaro?
The son of Starro or something like that?
Basically a piece of Starro, that part of...
Isn't he Batman's team or something?
Yeah, and it's one of the... I forgot exactly like the whole thing with it was, but it happened during Justice League No Justice, and it is one of the best creations of the past 10 years.
Yeah, well, I was catching up with Death Metal. I had read one of the, I don't even think it's a spinoff story, just one of the side stories, got piecing out information that wasn't in the main series that had Jaro in it. And I was like, what is this? This is fantastic.
It's just one of those ideas, like, why didn't we think of this? It's Jaro is the DC, what Baby Yoda is the Star Wars.
Basically, yeah. I can see that.
But more disgusting.
And so that is basically the story of New Frontier. But before we close out everything, I wanted to touch on a few other things, such as our typical random trivia section. But I also wanted to take a moment with the animated movie, Justice League, The New Frontier, because there were some changes, but it also had some... obviously, it's hard to fit the entirety of New Frontier into, what was it, like an 80-minute movie?
Yeah, it's hard to fit nearly 400 pages into that.
And so,
and something that small.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this next part of the podcast, we'll be talking about both the animated movie along with some extra tidbits about the New Frontier. So starting with the animated movie, so basically what happened was Paul Levitz and Gregory Novak, the creative services VP at DC, would speak with WB Home Video to have three direct-to-video animated movies that revolved around specific stories, and one of them happened to be New Frontier. However, Darwin was neck deep in The Spirit that had just launched, so he was unable to write the script. So instead, they brought on Stan Berkowitz, former associate of the 90s animated Batman Superman cartoons,
in general, just animated DCAU.
Mm-hmm. So he wrote the first four drafts, and then Darwin would go through and polish and rewrite anything at the end. Darwin also didn't have time for the entire storyboard process and only contributed about 10% of it, roughly 140 to 150 pages of the 1,400-page storyboard. And according to Darwin, Warner Studio was a nightmare to deal with in a way.
Still is.
Yeah, that's not entirely wrong there.
We could fix just the... No, I want my money.
So during the scripting of the screenplay at least, characters such as Wonder Woman and Lois Lane were missing because they felt there wasn't enough time for all the characters featured in No Frontier. But Darwin fought hard, especially for Lois, noting how she is the glue to link things together and is a perfect way for exposition due to being in front of a microphone. Ultimately, what was cut was decided based on what the focus would become. As the title of the animated movie shows, Justice League, The New Frontier, the main focus was on Justice League characters, such as Flash and Green Lantern. Much of what was cut would be the tangential stories that didn't involve the Justice League. So to try and get around this, the team would insert characters into scenes just to be on the screen, although they may not have any speaking parts, such as Adam Strange, John Henry, characters like that. So some of the beginning parts were folded into the opening credits, such as the JSA disappearing, Our Man's death, and the movie starts with the last story of the center, as opposed to the losers and Dinosaur Island. So I wasn't going to sit here and list all of the changes between the movie and the book, but I did have some here. So obviously, the movie is much faster paced, and scenes are a bit out of order compared to how they're done in the book. Center takes a very more proactive approach in announcing his coming. For example, the scene with Barry and Captain Cold. Captain Cold is used as a mouthpiece for the center, as the center kind of takes over his mind and talks through him, basically. He also does the same with the cultists that John Jones and Batman run across in the church. Instead of Wonder Woman being the person to tell Superman that the country needs a leader, this happens with Lois as her and Superman speak on top of the Daily Planet building. There's also no scene of Hal meeting his hero as a child, but in the movie he does visit the same bar with the same bartender, Poncho, when he learns about the center's attack. Batman brings in Ray Palmer to the battleground instead of Adam Strange. And as opposed to the book, Batman is actually involved in the final battle using his bat plane in the attack on the center. Ace is never explicitly mentioned to be part of the Challengers of the Unknown, but he is in purple, and the rest of the Challengers are shown as well. And then the opening issue of the book has Cloud of the Losers going out by pulling grenades and jumping into the T-Rex mouth. In the movie, it's Faraday during the ending battle, which is also the catalyst for John to get his mind back. Was there anything else from the animated movie you wanted to touch on before we get to the more trivia part of it?
No, not really.
Yeah. I feel like we've talked pretty well about the animated movie in general these past few episodes. So it's good. If you haven't seen it, go watch it.
There is, when it comes to the trivia, there is something that I'm surprised you didn't catch.
Please tell me it's not another misspelling or something.
Oh no,
I've had plenty of that the last two episodes.
No, it's something that was said during Rebirth.
Okay, it's possible I missed it since I wasn't really reading all of Rebirth. So, yeah, feel free to insert it kind of wherever you feel it best fits in.
Oh no, I can just say it.
Okay.
Superman Rebirth. They have, if I remember correctly, yes, the second volume of Superman series has Cal and John on Dinosaur Island.
Oh, that's right. I totally forgot about that.
As much as I hate to, I'll post it in chat. I posted in the doc, but I don't want to give the certain site it's from credit.
Yeah, I forgot they do that because Tomasi did a good job with that. I mean, Tomasi did a great job with pretty much any book he's on, but I really liked his Superman.
Patrick Gleason did a good job of drawing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those two can do no wrong in my eyes.
It's a real shame that Gleason went to Marvel.
Yeah. So some of the random trivia stuff I found. The first includes the Absolute Edition of New Frontier, as it has 12 previously unpublished pages in it. Darwin thought he could include up to 48 unpublished pages, but DC thought that may be too much, so they settled on 12. Much of what could have been included were things that felt unnecessary because people already knew how they worked, such as the powers of the Flash or more of Martian Manhunter's backstory. However, because Darwin thought the Dinosaur Island scene with the Suicide Squad was cool, especially in explaining how people started going mad and how the island had an effect on people, that is what was stuck. So these extra pages would be featured in later collections as well. Is that something that you saw in your deluxe edition?
There are like different pages that aren't really like given much detail.
Yeah, I kind of wish that was the one that was on Comixology, but oh well, I'll take what I can get. So there was also a special issue of New Frontier that was released around the time of the animated film. This would include three stories that take place within or just outside the story. I'll be talking about that here in a bit. I'll kind of go through the story there. There's also a short story in Solo number 5, which is written and drawn by Darwin Cook, about Faraday, set in pre-revolutionary Cuba. I have not read that, so I don't know how it is, but I'm sure it's fantastic, as most things by Darwin are.
Just a little thing I just found. For the, they have Rip Hunter mm-hmm. in the New Frontier animated special comic. If he comes out in a time sphere, he has a gun in one hand, like, "Hey everyone, I'm Rip Hunter, Time Master."
Yeah.
Welcome to the New Frontier animated special. And he's saying this with a pipe in his mouth. They asked me to explain to y'all just which world this takes place in continuity-wise. He's wearing the Davy Crockett cap, too. Starts off with, like, very funny stuff, and he's like, hundreds of years ago, they said the world was flat. Today, experts will try and tell you there are 52 worlds. Like, multiple Earths, and, like, him reaching out with his right arm. The other arm is still holding the gun.
Yeah, Darwin is pretty good about being cheeky about all that. Yeah, we'll get to that here in a second.
Yeah, and he like just goes, "Excuse me a sec," and he just fires a shot, and like, got him. That creature is a parasite that ravaged the era. They called them aluminum siding salesmen. Anyway, my point is this. Who cares what world we're on? Just sit back and enjoy these untold stories from the last heroic age. Which, that is a very great way to handle this.
Yeah.
Like, from continuity standpoint.
Well, since we're on it, let's go ahead and talk about that issue before I get to the last few points I had. So yeah, the first story is called The Greater Good, and this is about the Batman vs. Superman fight. And so it shows Faraday talking with Superman and Wonder Woman, and him showing slides of who the Batman is. And he wants them to bring Batman in after regular government people couldn't. Wonder Woman sides against it, saying nothing good coming from standing against a man who's fighting the good fight. So she walks out of the meeting and greets Bruce Wayne, who owns the boat for the summit in neutral territory. Superman meets up with President Eisenhower and speaks his indecisiveness about what he's being told to do. And Eisenhower tries to explain his stance before asking how Clark's parents are doing.
Oh, speaking of that, I just forgot. Like, this suddenly came back in my head when I forgot who it's. I think it's. Is it Hal when Rick Flagg Sr. and Karen die? It's his narration of the funeral and everything. And he mentions how, it's either him or someone else, mentions how Ike rolled out the 22-round, thanks salute that's reserved for only dead presidents.
Yeah, they say that Ike actually teared up when he got the news. He ordered a full 21-gun salute at the funeral, an honor usually reserved for Memorial Day and dead presidents.
Yeah, when I'm pretty sure that them finding the picture that Karen painted of her and Rick Flagg Sr., that actually got me.
Yeah, they didn't really focus too much on the relationship between Karen and Rick. I think that it would have been nice to have that have been fleshed out a little bit more. But it's still, as a lot of things Darwin did in this book, he didn't have to dive too deep into it.
Yeah, he just had to make, like, the character. Certain writers go overboard with making you, like, doing all these things to make you feel for the character. Darwin just did a few things, and like even if it was just a background character, you felt for the character. So as you were saying with Bennett, the greater good.
Yeah, that's basically where that scene ends. Is Eisenhower? Basically, we find out that Eisenhower knows who Clark's parents are. But yeah, the next scene is Lex being upset about his piece of kryptonite being stolen. And the next panel, we see Catwoman handing it over to Batman in preparation of what's to come. Superman flies in, seeing the bat signal, unsure of how Batman knows he's coming. And Superman finds a note there reading, "Think fast," before dodging a Batmobile fired missile, then being covered in government shelved toxic junk. As Batman drives off, Superman quickly makes up the distance before being blinded by oil that has him fly into the side of a mountain. Batman drives down a lead-lined cave, with his location being disguised from other audio of engine revving coming from multiple places throughout this cave. One sonic blast later, and as Superman is on his knees, Batman drives by on the Batcycle and launches a kryptonite grappling hook of sorts that pierces Superman's chest, and Batman drags Superman behind him to a location holding a cell to trap him in. Superman struggles and pops the grappling hook out, resulting in Batman crashing and both getting knocked out for a short time. But Batman makes it up first, kicks Superman and insults him being motherless, which I got real Batman vs. Superman vibes from that little scene there. And then Wonder Woman breaks in and stops the fight. She tells Superman to stop following orders and to follow his heart, and then criticizes Batman for building a cage to do to Superman what they would do to him, and that there must be some darkness in him to respond like that. Superman says he can't trust Batman, a man who hides behind a lead-lined mask, so Batman shows that he's Bruce Wayne. Everything is hunky-dory, and they all agree to work together and convince the world that even Superman can't bring Batman in, while in the end, they will eventually work together as the Trinity for the betterment of the world. And so this is where we find out that the whole Superman getting beat by Batman in the beginning section of New Frontier, how it was all staged, essentially, by the trio.
Man, if this was put out in the 60s, it'd be just added more fuel to the fire, like, or to the arguments that people would have. Actually, no, it would make things easier for add to the lunchtime like arguments. Like, what are you talking about? Batman can't beat Superman.
Yeah, if it comes down to it, if Superman isn't like bloodlusted or anything, Batman should win, because Batman will pull out all the stops, whereas Superman will always hold back. But yeah,
that's something else that we forgot to mention. We got when Wonder Woman seemingly dies, we get shot of Cal with the red eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically just means he's really aggroed.
So the second story in this special issue is called Drag Strip Riot, and has Robin and Kid Flash. So Robin is doing an investigation on some stolen explosives. It leads him to some street racers, so he investigates by doing some racing of his own. During the race, his opponent has some car trouble due to some sabotage from the people he is looking into, but his opponent is nowhere to be found after the crash. As police arrives, Robin speeds off to the location they are at, thanks to the tip from a girl they left behind. When he gets there, some of the men are already tied up, thanks to Kid Flash. Robin and Kid Flash are both investigating the same thing, and they both realize they were each other's opponent in the race. Kid Flash assists Robin to get to the airfield in time to stop the explosions from killing the president, who is JFK, who is inbound. After busting some other crooks there, they go about their merry way. However, not before getting a signed picture with the president and him giving them the name of Teen Titans.
This is some good stuff to hear before everything is just gone to shit. It says a lot when I've forgotten the name of the book. Heroes in Crisis.
Oh. Yeah, I still haven't read that. I'm not sure I really want to, but I probably will at some point.
I mean, this is like this. It was happening right as Doomsday Clock was happening.
Mm.
So, like, Dick Grayson had no idea. Like, he wasn't even Dick Grayson anymore. He was Rick Grayson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why do I even bother with DC anymore?
Well, hopefully that stuff will change here in the next few months, but we'll see. So the third story in this issue is kind of a, it's a pretty funny story here. It involves Wonder Woman and Black Canary. So Wonder Woman is busting some heads with Black Canary watching. Wonder Woman is frustrating. Oh my God, I don't even understand why I'm putting my notes here. Okay, so Wonder Woman is frustrated with men and how society treats women as lesser sexes. They grab a Playboy-like magazine and look at it, and Wonder Woman's completely disgusted by it, while Black Canary questions if she went to middle school with the woman. Black Canary mentions a club with women dressed as rabbits that will be opening in Gotham next week, and both of them will be attending it. Wonder Woman and Black Canary both go, and Wonder Woman is dressed as a secretary, while Black Canary is blending in much better with her more known attire of fishnets and everything. So Wonder Woman catches Bruce Wayne there, who quickly splits upon being seen. And Wonder Woman has seen enough when she hears that Hollywood sex bomb Janie Mansfield will be busting out of a cake for their pleasure. And she did bust out of a cake, but it's because Wonder Woman pulls her out, then strips off her secretary outfit back to her Wonder Woman garb, and hides in the cake while Black Canary wheels her out. And Wonder Woman pops out when she's on stage and shames all the men for their piggish approach with women. She asks them to side with her in treating women better, but instead they throw glasses at her. She decides to use force instead. One man throws alcohol on her breastplate and lights it on fire. So she takes off her breastplate and beats him with it. The next panel is a bunch of men, missing teeth and black eyes, looking up at Wonder Woman from the ground. And Wonder Woman is obviously topless now. Black Canary tells her to put the top back on, and as they both walk out, thinking nobody will tell the story because all the journalists there are men and beaten pretty badly, we see a woman winking at the reader with a notebook, which, as far as I can tell, is referencing a feminist leader and journalist, Gloria Steinem. Could be wrong, but that's who I'm assuming it is.
I wouldn't be surprised, because I think it was the Silver Age. It was either Silver Age or the Bronze Age. When Wonder Woman gave up her powers and became a spy, basically, under the tutelage of I Ching, Gloria Steinem ended up she ended up doing an essay on Wonder Woman, and there's an infamous cover of Ms. Magazine with Wonder Woman. So I would not be surprised if that was her.
Yeah, this won't be the last we talk about Wonder Woman specifically in the follow-up episode to this. So we'll be talking more about Wonder Woman and kind of what she stood for and all that in 2 weeks from this episode posting. So yeah, that is the special issue that came out with the animated movie. But yeah, let me knock out these last two trivia things, and then we can close up shop here. So one of, if not the most proudest parts of the story to Darwin, was involving the John Wilson character and the ties to John Henry. Darwin wanted to confront the racial issues of the 50s and the civil rights movement in general. And Darwin was well aware that he couldn't know what it was really like, but he thinks he did a pretty great job based on the praise he received from his black friends regarding those scenes. So he feels like he did a pretty great job and holds it up pretty highly because of that. And clearly the book is amazing, as anyone who's read it could attest to that. And the awards that it won clearly show that too. So I'm just going to name some of the awards that it won. So it won multiple Eisner Awards, including Best Limited Series, Best Coloring, Best Publication Design. It would also win Best Graphic Album Reprint with the release of the Absolute Edition. It won Harvey Awards for Best Artist, Best Colorist, Best Continuing or Limited Series. The Absolute Edition would also win Best Graphic Album of Previously Published Work. And it also won a Shuster Award for Outstanding Canadian Comic Book Cartoonist. So it has plenty of accolades to go with it, and it's all well-deserved because New Frontier is an amazing piece of work, and hopefully Darwin's no longer with us, but hopefully he held it pretty highly in his proudest works that he did in his life, because it really is fantastic. So the last thing I wanted to do before we get into the closing thing is read the app that Darwin had wrote for the story, but I'll leave that as kind of the closing comments of the book, since if anyone is going to talk about it, I feel like Darwin should have the last word on it. So before then, is there anything else you want to mention before we close everything up?
Oh, well, as we mentioned last week, or I mentioned last week, or last episode, with the Comicsgate stuff with Darwin, the claims that were made, mm-hmm. the Wonder Woman and Black Canary, that mini story just says everything about where Darwin felt on, like, quality and everything. Same with the John Henry stuff.
Yeah, it's clear where his morals lie. And I can't imagine anyone with half a brain would think he was anything but a decent human being based on just this book alone. Clearly he has, you know, in his head where women's rights should be, where black rights should be and all that. I can't figure out how anyone would think anything different of this dude. So with that, let me get into the afterword from the New Frontier Trades that Darwin Cook wrote in Toronto of 2005. And so everything here is from Darwin. It occurs to me as I attempt to type this obligatory comment on such a large and fresh piece of work that it is probably a little too soon for any kind of objective analysis of the work itself. As a matter of course, I prefer to avoid explaining what a piece like this means. Depending on your in to the story, it could be seen as a love letter to a bygone era or an allegorical reflection of contemporary concerns. Big shoot 'em up with a giant monster or a character-driven historical melodrama. The choice, as always, should belong with the reader. Whether New Frontier heralds a return to the heroic ideal or is simply a reminder that it existed remains to be seen. I like to abandon the rather cramped quarters of industry discussion or literary self-analysis and try to explain the spirit of this book through a quick story. Dave Thomas was the genial Buffalo television personality that portrayed WKBW's astronaut host of their weekday morning kids show, Rocket Ship 7. Set in an imaginary rocket ship, the lively 90-minute show featured skits, news, and tips for kids, the obligatory visits from magicians and zookeepers, and glorious uncut Warner Brothers cartoons. On Fridays, Rocket Ship 7 had a weekly feature called Draw Along with the Scope View. This was the late 60s, and the world was astro-crazed. Rocket Ship 7 did its low-budget best to put across to its young viewers that this was really unfolding on a high-tech space vehicle. Devices like the Scope View went a long way towards convincing us. The Scope View was essentially an old-school wall-mounted blue screen for viewing clips and photos, but on Fridays, they would have a fairly talented artist sit behind the screen. And on a very thin piece of paper, he would draw a picture with a thick marker. The illusion was perfect. From the front, the Scope View seemed to be drawing the picture like some futuristic machine or something. The challenge was to draw along with the Scope View and try to do your best. Those Friday mornings, I would perch in my chair, pencil at the ready, in a world where anything was possible. A world of magic televisions in space, sunny mornings full of promise, and my drawing. And before anyone gets up to leave before speech 12,367 about how these were better days, relax. It wasn't the times or the place or the cultural comforts of the era. It was something you can find anywhere, at any time. It was the earnest faith of youth. Inevitability. I grew older and one day realized the Scope View was an elaborate scam. A parlor trick that only a kid would fall for. It didn't cause me to write into the station and demand more realistic drawing lessons involving more serious themes. I didn't run around trying to tell people that the Scope View had artistic merit that only a select few were sensitive enough to divine. I simply sought out more detailed and realistic instruction. My youngest brother is several years my junior. When he began to sit on Fridays, pencil in hand, I felt no need to ridicule the Scope View or change it to fit my more adult taste. I wanted him to take that little scrap of magic forward with him as I had. The Scope View wasn't real. It was an imaginative fiction that was better than real, constructed to help you in some small way to develop your own youthful imagination. Just like Astronaut Dave was there to help us learn the Golden Rule. Which brings us around to superheroes. Specifically, the Justice League. The world will always have dark corners, and black and white comes in thousands of shades of gray. But here are seven people, good and true, come what may. They have the power to enslave the world, but work tirelessly to keep it free. They don't succumb to envy, greed, or jealousy, and their sense of purpose is driven by an unshakable faith in mankind's basic good. They are, in the best sense of the word, childlike. It is the very essence of the term superhero, an imaginative fiction that's better than real, constructed to help you in some small way to develop your own youthful imagination and value system. I'm 42 now, and I suppose I believe that the magic of this specific genre is based on the notion that seven powerful people can work together to make the world a better place. That they will do the right thing, no matter what the personal cost, no matter how grim and gritty the world around them becomes. They are the heroic ideal. That is the spirit driving the characters in The New Frontier. Like my beloved Scope View, I suppose only a child could buy into such a ridiculous premise. But once it's in your heart, you can't help but take that little scrap of magic forward with you. Darwin Cook, Toronto, 2005. As always, thank you for listening. Please rate and review wherever you listen to the podcast. The more you rate, the more you review, decides how, you know, how far up or down we are on the charts. Any and all love is appreciated. And if there's anything we can do to improve, please let us know. It's the only way we know how to improve. Also, don't forget to follow Hypertime to Podcast on Twitter. And you can do that at HypertimePod. And if you have any questions or topic suggestions, feel free to reach out to us there, or you can email us at hypertimetopodcast@gmail.com. We also have other content you can fill your eyes and ears with, especially if you're into video games. You can check us out on vgu.tv. And Alan, can you double check the Twitter for me? Is it at vgu_TV?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And we also have two video game podcasts in Players Club Podcast and Win, so please check those out as well. We also have video content on the YouTubes, so check us out there as well. You can find me on Twitter at jmille99. That's J-M-I-L-L-E-99. And Alan, where can they follow you at? And where else would you like to promote while you're here?
You can find me on Twitter at TheAlanMuir, and I'll end with a tweet I posted 2 hours ago. Am I the only one who incorrectly pictures Ron Perlman's Fallout narrator character crouched in a small room while delivering the Fallout 2 monologue? No? Okay, me neither. I mean, if you listen to it, it sounds like he is in a very confined space.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, with that, we will call this episode as it is. I think it's been pretty good. I think these last two episodes have been pretty good for a big, beefy story like New Frontier.
Yeah.
Next episode will not be quite as big, where we will discuss... we'll leave that as a surprise, I suppose. Yeah, hopefully by now we'll see some special content coming through, and... I have some ideas that I would like to do in the future, and hopefully I'll be able to get that done. But we'll see. But with that, I hope you all take care, and we will see you further down the hype time. Bye!